The Debate.
Hello, welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. The third round of negotiations on reviving the Iran nuclear deal is underway in Vienna. Now, to that end, Tehran has come up with more detailed conditions, including guarantees to benefit from the deal this time, and for the trigger mechanism not to be activated in case of sanctions reimposition for whatever reason. Now, Tehran is setting the conditions to ascertain its economic benefits under JCPOA, to which it has adhered without benefiting much. Now, we'll have a report on details of Tehran's demands in the Vienna talks, and then we'll put that issue up for debate with our panelists. Stay tuned.
Iran and the remaining signatories of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action are holding a new round of talks in Vienna in an effort to save the nuclear agreement nearly 3 years after Washington's unilateral withdrawal in 2018. As talks continue over a spat of issues, the Islamic Republic has reiterated its demands for returning back to compliance with the JCPOA. That's according to two sources who informed Press TV of the conditions.
Iran's demands regarding JCPOA talks. The United States must remove sanctions that prevent Iran from benefiting from the JCPOA. Legal institutions will accept the outcome of the Vienna talks only once all U.S. sanctions are removed and the removal is verified by Tehran. The United States has to guarantee that it won't use the snapback mechanism after rejoining the deal. The United States has to pay for the losses it inflicted on Iran by withdrawing from the JCPOA.
According to the sources, the United States has to guarantee that foreign companies cooperate with the Islamic Republic following Washington's rejoining of the agreement. Press TV analysts say COTSA and Iran Sanctions Act, visa bans, the dollar U-turn, and Section 311 of the Patriot Act are fundamental obstacles to Iran's gains under the JCPOA. Press TV analysts say among such obstacles are also a number of U.S. President's executive orders that prohibit transactions with respect to Iran and block property of Iranian individuals, governments, and financial institutions. They also say failing to remove sanctions, a 120-day or 180-day sanction waivers, also deprive Iran of benefits stipulated under the JCPOA. Observers believe Tehran has reasons to persist with its demands.
Iran has experienced so much deceitful measures under the nuclear deal by the United States, and the U.S. deceitful measures have inflicted harms over the deal, so Iran is trying to block any such move in future.
The JCPOA revival talks come as Iranian officials have time and again warned that Tehran will not allow the negotiations to become attritional. Iran's top negotiator in Vienna and Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says the Islamic Republic would stop the negotiations if it detects that the other side lacks seriousness, tries to buy time, or seek to add new topics to those under discussion. Iran insists that the 2015 nuclear agreement can only be salvaged if its demands are met and that its conditions are the country's definitive policy. Former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the Iran nuclear deal in May 2018. Tehran, however, waited for a year, gave leeway to the European signatories to make up for the U.S. pullout, but the so-called E3 failed to abide by their commitments. Now, with the new U.S. administration in office for nearly 100 days, Washington has so far failed to take any solid measure to return to the deal. All in all, Iran says the ball is in the U.S.'s court to return to the agreement and remove all the sanctions on Tehran or pursue the failed policy of predecessor, known as maximum pressure campaign, and push ahead with its hostile policy against the Islamic Republic.
Okay, that was Mehdi Fahmy, reporter. And let me now invite my guests. We have analyst and political commentator Mohan Abedin in our studios tonight with us, and also Iranian affairs expert Kevin Sharara, who's joining us out of Beirut, the Lebanese capital. Welcome, gentlemen, to the show. In our studio first, Mohan, I want to ask you about Iran. Iran keeping reminding the interlocutors in the Vienna talks that this deal will survive only if all the sanctions are removed and that, you know, at a go. Why is Iran insisting on this and keeping reminding the U.S. especially about this?
Well, this is the fundamental Iranian position. I mean, this is the bottom line from Iran's point of view, and it reflects Iran's experience with the JCPOA over the past 6 years. Even during the Obama administration, when the nuclear deal was first agreed, very few sanctions were actually lifted, and the Obama administration kept dragging its heels. And Iran, let's not forget, only agreed to restrict its civilian nuclear program for complete sanctions relief. That was the original deal. And even Obama reneged on that. And we all know what happened when Trump came to power. A unilateral U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018. So this Iranian position reflects a very bitter experience. Mm. And the Americans have actually withdrawn from this deal unilaterally. First of all, by principle, it makes sense that they should actually revoke all the sanctions, all the JCPOA-related sanctions, mm-hmm. the nuclear sanctions, and all the Trump-era sanctions before Iran actually decides to come back.
You mean they're the ones to take the first action first? Because they were the first ones to leave.
This, I think everybody would agree, even some people in the American administration, it makes total sense mm-hmm. for the Americans to make the first step. As a confidence-building gesture. But also, again, let's not forget Iran's bitter experience with the JCPOA. Mm-hmm. And that's what actually determines Iran's position and Iran's demand that all sanctions, they not only have to be lifted, they have to be verifiably lifted.
Right. Okay, now let me turn to Beirut. We have Karim Shahrer there. Karim, it seems that the United States is complicating the revival of the deal because it's refusing to lift all the Trump-era sanctions on Iran. That's what Tehran is asking. Why is that?
To the very beginning of the talks, I mean, you can see that from the get-go, the United States was intent on lowballing the Iranian side. They would not commit to anything. They were not going to commit to a verification of the sanctions relief. They weren't going to commit to long-term to anything beyond their current administration with regards to the to the deal itself. So I think they were just biding for time. And I think if we go back to Ayatollah Khamenei's speech before the talks, you can clearly see that he was very observant with regards to the Americans' intents, because he told the Iranian team that they should be wary of the talks dragging on. And I think that's what the U.S. was counting on. I mean, there were two versions of this all, before the talk started anyway. The first version was that the United States wanted a speedy resolution and a speedy reconciliation with Iran so that they can influence domestic politics in Iran, bringing back a more moderate president. But then Ayatollah Khamenei said about the talks dragging on, then you had another version, which was that the United States wasn't intent on a speedy resolution to all of this, but really wanted the talks to drag on so that they can keep lowballing Iran and reach a more something that would be more suitable to them without mm-hmm. giving any reasonable concessions to the Iranians. So okay. Now that the Iranians that the Iranian team has gone back to the talks with a renewed spirit, if I might say, not only asking for sanctions relief and not only asking for the United States to go back to the JCPOA as it was, not only asking for guarantees, no, they're now asking for compensation as well, which is what they should have done in the first place, actually, because mm-hmm. if you see that the United States is going to lowball you, well, you're going to have to raise the stakes if you want to reach a suitable
I'll come to that point also, Inertia. Now, let me ask Mahan. Mahan, you know that Iran had been in full compliance with the nuclear deal mm-hmm. as it was endorsed by IAEA multiple times, 14, 15 times. Mm-hmm. And yet, the country did not enjoy much economically from the deal. So that is why that this time around, in order mm-hmm. to stop this from recurring, Iran is asking for guarantees so that if anything should go wrong, Iran knows at least that it can continue with its business even for a certain period of time. So let's have your comment.
Well, absolutely. Well, one of the key Iranian demands is that at least for the next 4 years, sanctions have to be lifted. Not only that, but the foreign companies that were operating here as part of the post-JCPOA settlement, they should be able to operate here without fear of sanctions or anything related to that for at least 4 years. Mm-hmm. There's, of course, the demand for compensation, which our colleague in Beirut just set out. But also another key Iranian demand is that the so-called snapback power, which other signatories have, this should be revoked. because of obviously the Trump administration tried to do that. They initially withdrew withdrew unilaterally, but then last September, in a very odd move, they tried to snap back sanctions, and that really backfired totally against them. But nevertheless, again, in principle, this snapback option is inimical to the whole spirit of the deal, and this should be revoked. But look, the most important thing here is that sanctions have to be verifiably lifted. I mean, the only reason Iran has agreed initially 6 years ago to cut back on its civilian nuclear program was that its economy would not be under any pressure. There would be no sanctions. We could trade and engage with the world at a financial, economic level without any kind of coercion, without any kind of hindrance. This should come into fruition immediately. So there has to be verification of the sanctions lifting process. And look, Iran is in a position where it has plenty of leverage. This is where I slightly disagree with our colleague in Beirut. The United States is in no position to influence domestic politics here. I don't think that's part of their game plan here. What the Americans are trying to do, basically, is trying to offer Iran a kind of a watered-down deal, putting Iran in a difficult position, again, without guarantees. So we agree to yet another nuclear deal, and in a couple of years, we again start experiencing difficulties. Another scenario is that the Americans are going for something like JCPOA plus, something that was also discussed during the Trump administration, you know, add more conditions to the JCPOA, for instance, bring in elements of Iran's national defense power or issues very sensitive to Iran's national security. This is an absolute no-no. The Iranian leadership from the top down has made it quite clear that JCPOA is a nuclear-specific agreement, and it stays at that level. Any kind of discussion about Iran's national defense power is an absolute taboo, is not going anywhere.
Exactly. Let's get it over with this and implement it, then we can talk about other things if possible.
Yeah.
Now, Kerim, the Islamic Republic did not benefit much from the nuclear deal once it signed it, and since former President Trump took the U.S. out of the JCPOA and thus prevented foreign companies and banks from trade and transaction with Iran, Iran even started losing instead of gaining anything from the deal. So naturally, this is what you're alluding to. Tehran should be compensated for all those losses, maybe a couple of trillion dollars, if I remember right, shouldn't it?
Well, if you take into account that the American administration's comportment towards Iran, I mean, this wasn't defensive in any way, and this wasn't just a case of trying to contain Iran. This was done with malice. Maximum pressure is about causing maximum harm to Iran and the Iranian people. I mean, for example, if you go to the U.S. Treasury, you will see that they really specify that these sanctions aren't meant to harm the Iranian people. As they claim. But if you put these into practice, I mean, most of the food companies and most, if not all, pharmaceutical companies during the Trump administration tried to stay away from Iran as much as they could, even though they could have dealt with Iran, but they were really afraid that the United States would have gone after them under any kind of pretext because they dealt with Iran. So although the United States comportment was that of leaving a humanitarian space for dealings with Iran, this wasn't implemented on the ground. This was done with malice. They wanted to harm the Iranian people. So this was done with criminal intent. Should the Iranian side be compensated? Yes, of course they should be compensated. But is this going to happen? I don't think that the United States would agree to such a measure. It's like you said. I mean, just being back in the deal and having it implemented as it should have been implemented is more than sufficient. If you take into consideration, for example, the fact that the wording of the deal was in such a way that the sanctions would be suspended and not lifted or removed, well, that's one thing that should have been taken into account. Another thing that should have been taken into account is the fact that, well, yes, the nuclear sanctions were lifted, but these sanctions could have been brought back upon Iran in under any kind of other pretext, call it ballistic missiles, sanctions, call it anything else, sponsoring terrorism, if you will.
Right.
This is what the Iranian side is trying to debate now, that is trying to negotiate against. If you want to bring back, if you cannot bring back the sanctions any under a different pretext, be it nuclear or be it anything else.
That's true. That's why Mohan is also in that verifiable means,
well,
practically
actually,
removing all these.
Yeah, our colleague in Beirut actually raised a very important point, is that, look, even during the Obama administration, a lot of these sanctions were so-called suspended or waived. This is not good enough. They have to be lifted. They have to be abolished.
For Iran to be able to benefit.
Absolutely, yes. And so there has to be clarity on that. And there has to be verification. And from my understanding, from reading the appropriate literature and listening to the appropriate people, that will take at least a few months. So nobody should be in a hurry here to reach the
agreement.
Because
it's all the sectors.
Yeah, so to reach an agreement within a few weeks or a couple of months. No, no one's in a hurry. Iran actually, again, our colleague is right, the Trump administration imposed this so-called maximum pressure campaign with a lot of malice. It was with criminal intent. There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
But the other side is, it didn't work. The Iranian economy proved to be far more resilient than most people gave it credit for. So we've survived this for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
We can survive it for sure for another 3 years. It's nobody's in a hurry to come to a faulty agreement. So if we're going to reestablish the JCPOA, to reseal the deal, so-called, you know, it should be done properly on sound foundations. And at minimum, again, our colleague raised the issue of compensation. That's a key Iranian demand. But I think, first of all, at minimum, these sanctions have to be verifiably lifted. Another issue is that Iran has rejected, not necessarily the so-called step-by-step issue. If the Americans want to do it incrementally, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But they shouldn't expect Iran to go for a step-for-step process. They do something, Iran does something. Iran has rejected that. But if the Americans want to take their time and lift this slowly, that's fine. But Iran will only go back into compliance once all the JCPOA-related sanctions have been verified.
That's right, and Iran has made it pretty clear.
So the nuances here are very important. So it's very important to have a full grasp of the details here, because
exactly.
We all want an agreement, but it has to be on proper foundations for it to be sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, let me ask Karim. Karim, you know that so far all the sides in Vienna are speaking of progress being made, and while at the same time admitting that major issues do remain. And the U.S. delegation is also there in attendance, and that's despite Tehran rejecting direct talks with it. Now, what would you expect to come out of the Vienna talks?
I think it's very optimistic to say that progress is being made. I mean,
that's what negotiators have been saying.
Yes. The talks have been shrouded in a lot of secrecy, but they've been saying that ever since the beginning. I mean, President Rouhani has said it. The 50 to 70% of the hurdles have been overcome, but then you go to the American side, and they barely say that 30% of it is done, or 30% of the hurdles, that is. So progress is being made. Well, okay, if you want progress to be made, then it should be upon the major step. They should be able to agree on the basics at the very least. I mean, I'm really not optimistic about the future of all this. Especially since, I mean, if you take into consideration the comportment of the Biden administration ever since they came to power, you have China, you have Russia, and you have Iran. They're triple threat. So what they've been able to accomplish so far is antagonize China, not only antagonize Russia, but bring a lot of European countries close to war with Russia. And now you have Iran, and they're not going... I don't think they're going to... risk a deal with Iran at such a particular point of time, when they need to amass, when they need to bring their allies in the Middle East close together. Not unless they, I mean, look, you have two fronts that the Americans have to deal with. Opening up a third front is foolish, but if anything, the Americans are going to work on destabilizing Iran domestically. I mean, that's proven to be their track record so far.
Okay.
I think things would be going if they see the deal as a way to undermine Iran's progress on the economic level. Look,
okay.
If you look at Iran's track record, I'm sorry.
Allow me, I get one more question, and then if we have time, I'll go back to you. And Mohan, we have heard that the White House is saying that the U.S. and Israel have agreed to set up this, what they call, working group to discuss Iran's drone and missile program. And have you heard of that, and what would that group do?
If they want to do that, that's fine. But that's independent of the JCPOA. That's their problem. If they want to, I mean, Iran is well within its rights to develop its national defense capability.
Mm-hmm.
And Iran is never, ever going to accept any restrictions on any of that. If they want to have their own working group to track Iran's progress, that's fine, that's their problem.
Mm-hmm.
But none of these can be brought into the JCPOA discussions. This is an absolute red line.
Okay.
And as far as I know, they haven't been raised, and hopefully they will not be raised. Just one issue about the progress. I think this is not really time sensitive. Nobody should be in a hurry. You know, as I said, Iran actually withstood Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
The Iranian economy proved resilient. Yes, the Americans wanted to destabilize this country, but they didn't succeed,
okay.
And they cannot succeed.
If you allow me, I'll give Karim 30 seconds. Karim, go ahead, 30 seconds.
Okay, basically, I just wanted to say that what you now have is Israeli-Saudi rapprochement, and I think that's a really a priority for the Americans, because they need to bring their allies closer together. What with Iran scoring so many victories in the region over the past few years, so if they need to face Iran at the regional level, that's what the Americans are going to be working on.
Okay.
They cannot give Iran a favorable deal if it's going to empower it in the region. If anything, they're going to try to undermine Iran through the deal, and that's what I think that what they were shooting for when they wanted to go back to the JCPOA, because Iran has shown its commitment to the JCPOA, to its diplomatic relations. But
okay.
When they try to undermine it through any other means,
okay, you got
to
jump in.
Iran
we're out of time. I'm sorry for interrupting you. We're just out of time. Let me thank our guests. We had analyst and political commentator Mohan Abed in our Tehran studio, and also Iran affairs expert Karim Sharara, who joined us from Beirut.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
اگر کسی بتونه شب‌های قدر رو در ماه‌های مبارک رمضان درک بکنه چیز فوق‌العاده‌ای گیرش میاد شما ببینید این بفهمید
If somebody can really recognize the significance of Qadr nights during the month of Ramadan he or she will gain something extraordinary. This is what is mentioned in the Holy Quran too, ayah number 3 of Surah Al-Qadr, which reads, the night of Qadr is better than 1,000 months, means that if you can experience the month of Ramadan and its nights of Qadr, then you will grow up naturally in terms of servitude of Allah. In other words, you will go to the higher level of servitude through the recognition of the nights of Qadr. In this way, you will remain on the same high level of the whole year. This is the case till the nights of Qadr of the next year. If in the next Ramadan you experience the nights of Qadr, then you can pass to another high level in your life spiritually and religiously.
به تعبیر ساده تر اگر کسی مثلا بتونه 10 تا شب قدر رو درک بکنه در ماه
In simple words, if we can experience 10 months of Ramadan and its nights of Qadr during our lifetime, it is as if we passed our whole life in servitude of Allah. This is true about experiencing 20 months of Ramadan too. Now, this is among the divine contributions of Allah for Muslims in general. These nights are also gifts and graces from Allah for those who are fond of Prophet Muhammad and Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam.
و کسانی که در محیط ولایت اهل بیت هستند داد.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The World with Reporters.
The socioeconomic malaise that has been worsened by the COVID crisis is erupting at an unprecedented level everywhere in Italy. Many hundreds large and small-scale protests have been held across the country over the past months. On Wednesday, thousands of street vendors staged a protest against a city decision to stop the extension of their licenses. They blocked the capital's ring road and occupied the central republic square as tens of thousands of itinerant street trading businesses are at risk of closure due to an EU directive on free trade.
Italy has been under attack since the EU introduced the Bolkestein Directive, which aims at establishing a single market for services. Our Parliament has already opposed the adoption of this provision.
We have been abandoned in these testing times. How dare they? The mayor wants to impose standards in Rome. She's killing us.
Also on Wednesday, pilots, flight attendants and other airline industry workers gathered in central Rome to stage a protest against a rescue plan to save the bankrupt former national airline Alitalia. The airline is running out of cash for fuel and salaries, and workers fear some 7,000 employees will be sacked if a buyout offer by a group of investors gets the green light from the government.
The government is not listening to our demands. We have not even been paid last month. That's how Alitalia special commissioners are treating us.
The Draghi government is not used to listening to workers' needs. I am afraid this executive can only make unpopular decisions.
Recently, Italy's parliament has overwhelmingly approved the government's European Union-funded pandemic recovery plan worth 248 billion euros. Prime Minister Draghi has pledged the plan would address both the damage caused by COVID and the country's long-standing structural issues.
Italy is at a crossroads. There is the risk that the pandemic may turn into an unprecedented socio-economic crisis that will drag on for a very long time. But Italians also have the opportunity to use the funds from a vigorous stimulus package of the EU to relaunch employment and growth. It remains to be seen whether the country will succeed in this process. Max Civili, Rome.
As the world marks World Immunization Week 2021, people in Gaza don't have enough vaccines because of Israeli restrictions. World Immunization Week, celebrated every year in the last week of April, aims to promote the use of vaccines to protect people of all ages against disease. The Gaza Strip has only received enough vaccines for about 50,000 people. More vaccines are desperately needed as the current volume of doses is not enough for the more than 2 million people living in Gaza. Despite the increasing number of COVID-19 infections in the Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of medical supplies, including vaccines.
Under international law, Israel as an occupying power must adopt and apply the prophylactic and preventive measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics in areas under its occupation. Israel must supply the people of the Gaza Strip with all necessary means to combat the coronavirus, including vaccines.
The surge in infections and deaths is threatening to overwhelm hospitals weakened by years of Israeli blockade. Currently, there are some 15,000 active coronavirus cases in the Gaza Strip.
Health situation is very dangerous and hospitals are going through very tough times. Every day we lose loved ones because of this deadly pandemic. We need all the necessary help to fight this wave of infections.
The weakness of the healthcare system makes Gaza's population highly vulnerable to further major outbreaks of the deadly pandemic. The enclave's health sector has been battered by the Israeli blockade and multiple wars.
The Israeli blockade since 2007 has taken its toll on Gaza's health sector and left it in a very bad shape. The health sector is fragile and suffers from acute shortages in medicines and hospital supplies to deal with deadly pandemic. Hospitals and medical centers also need more trained medical personnel to deal with the surge of infections.
The Gaza Strip is currently witnessing the worst wave of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Rights groups say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians living in the besieged coastal strip. The measures, they say, are making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A month of campaigning for an official British definition of Islamophobia has climaxed, with a flash mob protest staged by activist Maz Salim, who lit up government buildings with the image of her father, Mohammed Salim, who was murdered by a racist terrorist in 2013.
I'm here outside UK Parliament to force this government, the media and the police to recognise my father's death as an act of terrorism, as well as the three mosque bombings in the West Midlands. It's been actually quite horrendous. Over the last 8 years, my father's death has been ignored on the mainstream media. Whenever they talk about acts of terrorism in the UK or on UK soil, my father's act of terrorism, and not only my father's death, the three mosque bombings that followed, have always been missed off the list, even though Pablo Lapshin was charged under terrorism laws. So my anger at the media and the politicians is, and the police as well, is intense.
Despite appeals from the family, British media refuses to prescribe the murder as a terrorist incident, which Ms. Salim believes comes from institutional Islamophobia.
When it's a Muslim who is the perpetrator, they get global media attention, back-to-back news headlines. But when the Muslim is the victim, we don't get the same media coverage.
Anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the increase under the current government's watch, with complaints met with silence.
When Prime Minister Boris Johnson referred to Muslim women as bank robbers and letterboxes in 2019, Islamophobic incidences surged, with a 375% spike recorded at the time. Now, with such high-level leadership engaging in anti-Muslim prejudice, can we expect to see meaningful change despite the tireless effort from these anti-racism campaigners? That has yet to be seen. Robert Carter, London.
Amid the continued advancement of the Yemeni army in the city of Marib, the Saudi-led coalition has begun to build new military camps in Shabwa and Al-Wadi'a areas to deploy more troops in the city.
What the Saudi-led coalition has in mind by building new military camps in Shabwa and Al-Wadi'a areas shows that the coalition is losing the control of Marib. It is now desperately trying to keep the city under its control, but the Yemeni army is determined to liberate all Yemeni lands.
The latest measures by Saudi-led coalition in Marib comes after Yemeni army backed by allied fighters from popular committees took control of strategic areas, including Tum al-Ulya Hill, which is 4 kilometers away from the western neighborhoods of the city of Marib.
Al-Tum al-Ulya Hill has a great military and strategic importance as it can provide Yemeni army with a good opportunity to achieve its military goals. The hill overlooks the city of Marib, so the Yemeni army will be able to target the enemy inside the city.
The Yemeni army has also intensified its retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia. Earlier, Yemeni troops launched an attack with a drone of Qasif K2 against King Khalid Air Base in Asir in Britain for the ongoing Saudi war and siege.
Yemenis say their army will continue its operations to liberate all the Yemeni lands, including the oil-rich province of Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Turkey vowed to respond duly to U.S. President Joe Biden's recognition of the events of 1915 as a genocide. Back on Saturday, Joe Biden said the U.S. honors the victims of the Metz-Yeghern so that the horrors of what happened were never lost to history. He became the first U.S. president to officially recognize the alleged Armenian genocide. Immediately after Biden's declaration, Turkey's foreign ministry denounced him in strongest terms, saying the move does not have a scholarly and legal basis, nor is it supported by any evidence. The ministry also summoned the U.S. ambassador to Ankara to voice its protest against Washington. Meanwhile, Turkish defense minister said that the declaration by the U.S. president may disrupt peace in the region.
Historical events should not be used as a tool of conflict and setting an account. They should not be politicized. It is clear that such an environment will negatively affect ties between Turkey and Armenia, Turks and Armenians, as well as regional peace. It should be known that history cannot be rewritten through such political statements.
Relations between Turkey and U.S. have been in trouble, especially after U.S. imposed sanctions on Turkey, for purchasing Russian-made S-400 missiles. Ankara is also still angry at Washington for supporting and aiding Kurdish militants in Syria, which Turkey considers as terrorists. This statement is seen by many as an addition to the pile of tensions between the two NATO allies.
I think the declaration by the US President Biden will create further tensions between Ankara and Washington. The declaration is not legally binding. Turkey has always said it's ready to open its archive for evidence. However, the use of this card every now and then by Washington will create a strategic row between the two NATO allies.
Since Saturday, protests were held in front of the U.S. consulate in Istanbul, with demonstrators denouncing the statement and calling on Ankara to cut ties with Washington. Turkey often lodges a formal complaint when foreign governments describes the tragic wartime events in Ottoman Turkey as genocide. Ankara maintains that many people on both sides of the conflict lost their lives. It also proposed to the Armenian side on 2005 the establishment of a joint history commission to reach a just conclusion about the historical facts of that period. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Given the prevailing poverty in Afghanistan, active charities and relief organizations in the country normally increase their support to the most vulnerable people, mainly widows, orphans, and jobless people during the holy month of Ramadan. Imam Khomeini Relief Committee is one of the most active charity organizations in Afghanistan that has provided many services to Afghans, especially to poor families, since its establishment in Afghanistan at least two decades ago. Representatives of the Relief Committee of Imam Khomeini and Iranian Embassy in Kabul attended this iftari program at one of Kabul's orphanages as a show of support and respect to the culture of helping poor ones.
We view all Muslim countries, particularly Afghanistan, as our brothers. We look to them as our own people. Iran and Afghanistan enjoy too much commonalities in terms of culture, religion, society, and many other fields. That is why we proudly do whatever in our power to help them.
The participation of the delegation of Iranian embassy in Kabul in events like this is usually welcomed by Afghans.
Iran is our neighbor and an Islamic country. We consider it as a brother nation who has always supported us in different fields such as culture, economy, politics, and social affairs, especially since the war began in Afghanistan.
As observers say, Iran is one of greatest supporters of Afghanistan that has extensively backed the people and governments of Afghanistan since decades ago. Currently, Tehran plays a key role in Afghanistan and is supporting Kabul's policies, especially in terms of bringing peace to the war-ravaged country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The EU's controversial border and coast guard agency Frontex is on course to receive greater power to deport up to 500,000 refugees who have had their applications for asylum in the EU rejected. Frontex is under investigation over allegations that it has aggressively pushed back refugees trying to reach the 27-country bloc.
The European agency always have to comply with fundamental rights. And I don't think that it's right to accuse that Frontex is not doing that. And if there are shortcomings in Frontex, they have to be addressed.
The European Commission has just launched its so-called voluntary return and reintegration strategy. The European Trade Union Confederation and several rights groups say it's all about border control, deterrence, detention and deportation of refugees.
Let's have a common asylum policy between EU member states, put it into practice, and then we see where we are. Certainly, this is not going to stop.
Just last week, 130 refugees drowned after their dinghy capsized in the Mediterranean as they attempted to reach the EU. Frontex vessels didn't get to the scene on time. The situation is not good for those who do make it to the bloc. More than 20,000 refugees are currently trapped on Greek and Spanish islands. Those include children, pregnant women, and people with mental health problems. They are surviving in trailers and tents and have limited access to essential services, including water. EU countries have made it clear they don't want to house refugees.
Denmark is pushing ahead with plans to deport Syrians back to their war-torn country. Rights groups say this is astonishing given the role the West played in practically destroying the Arab Republic. Aid agencies say the EU is paying billions of euro to Turkey and African countries to prevent refugees from trying to seek asylum here. This as the EU is being forced to defend the actions of its own agencies.
We will not accept this Frontex bashing that comes so cheap.
Rights groups say the EU continues to breach the 1951 UN Refugee Convention, which obliges the bloc to protect asylum seekers. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Following another meeting with the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal in Vienna, Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says there are still big challenges ahead. As diplomatic attempts continue to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, the main problem is still who should come back first, Iran or the US.
The problem or the challenge is about the sequence of who should come first. Who should come first to full compliance and full implementation of its commitments. On that, obviously, there are still differences. Our position is quite clear, and we are not going to change that.
Russia and China support Iran's demand that the U.S. remove sanctions in a verifiable manner first.
We believe it is the U.S. previous administration who first pulled out from the JCPOA. So it's just axiomatic that U.S. should abolish all its unilateral sanctions against Iran, as well as any third party in the first place, before Iran moved to implement the provisions on the JCPOA accordingly. So this is a fundamental issue involving rights versus wrong.
There are also serious differences on which sanctions the U.S. should remove.
Our position is quite clear. All sanctions should be lifted. All sanctions which are mentioned in the JCPOA and any new sanctions imposed after the adoption day of the JCPOA, including everything during Trump administration.
Up until now, two working groups have been trying to come up with a final list of U.S. sanctions that need removing and nuclear measures that need to be taken by Iran. From Wednesday, a third working group will begin discussions on timetables and sequence, as well as ways to verify sanctions lifting. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
For the fifth consecutive day, India has recorded an overwhelming number of COVID-19 infections. The country lodged around 350,000 fresh cases and about 2,700 deaths, raising fears of further devastation and dismay among its citizens. Many experts say the numbers are underestimations and that the real figures are likely to be much higher than the government figures. By Sunday, the number of total cases in the world's second most populous nation stood at 17 million, with over 192,000 deaths.
India is witnessing scenes of utter mayhem amid new wave of the outbreak. The hospitals have been overwhelmed and are turning away patients due to lack of beds and oxygen supplies, revealing the vulnerability of India's healthcare system.
Many Indian states have now imposed more stringent restrictions on people's movement. Here in the capital, New Delhi, the lockdown has been extended for one more week as the cases are soaring rapidly. According to some estimations, more than 300 people are infected with COVID-19 every minute across the country. A few months ago, India seemed to be doing remarkably well in handling the COVID crisis, but experts say election campaigns, gatherings, and opening up of markets and public spaces aggravated the situation.
What we see on the TV about government data on deaths or infection is nothing but just a glimpse of actual numbers. Many cases are not even being reported, nor the calculations are accurate. This is not a pandemic. This is the sign of the judgment day. We don't even have a calculation of how many we cremate each day.
In his latest radio telecast, Prime Minister Narendra Modi urged the nation not to fall prey to rumors and assured that the free vaccination program will continue in full swing. The Indian leader said this storm has shaken the country. Leaders from across the globe have expressed their concern and extended support in every possible way. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Senior officials from all signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are in the Austrian capital, Vienna, discussing ways to revive the ailing accord. 3 weeks on, there's no tangible progress in the discussions. Iran's top negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, said if Iran feels the other parties are trying to buy time, Tehran will leave the talks.
We are not here to waste our time. We are not here to negotiate for negotiations. We are here to specify and identify the sanctions which should be lifted by the U.S.
In his weekly briefing, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, said there will be no agreement without an all-inclusive agreement.
We are not interested in lengthy talks, but we are also not in rush. The only principle that we are following is to fulfill all the benefits that Iran is supposed to get out of the JCPOA. Anything less than a wholesale, verifiable, and a single step removal of all sanctions is not accepted by Tehran.
The Vienna talks have so far failed to lead to concrete results. The major sticking point is the fact that the U.S. insists on pushing its own narrative, pressing for a step-for-step removal of the sanctions. Tehran has categorically rejected such a plan in the first place, saying Washington needs to verifiably remove all sanctions before Iran returns to full compliance.
All the sanctions, including those who have been imposed, reimposed, or relabeled, should be removed. The domestic politics of the United States is not our concern. In international relations and international law, governments are sole responsible bodies to fulfill the commitments of the states when they make.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal has survived almost 3 years of unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018. As a tit-for-tat, Iran reduced its own commitments by adopting a stepwise suspension of its nuclear commitments. The last remedial step involved ramping up the purity level of enriched uranium to 60%, above the 3.6% cap set by the deal. As the Vienna discussions are becoming sluggish, Tehran says there's no need for prolonged negotiations. Iranian officials say the path is clear. The U.S. must lift all anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to full compliance. Period. Otherwise, Iran will simply quit the talks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Back to Reality on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, and our dear guests. Let me ask them to introduce themselves.
Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullah. I am Zainab, totally stoked to be here with you guys.
Thank you. And, brother?
Salaam alaikum. Thank you very much. My name is Sayyid Ayman Rizvi, and I've been studying in the Hawza for the last 8 years, living in Qom.
Great. Sometimes God provides us with this opportunity to, like, do or follow the duties that we are required to do and we are commanded to do by Him, by God. And one of them being Ramadan.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people who dive into Ramadan and fasting, all right? But it is not really something like a big deal for them out of Ramadan. When they leave Ramadan, you don't see much change in them. Do you expect the Muslim community to have certain attributes, to have certain characteristics gained, obtained by them throughout Ramadan through fasting, all right? And what other characteristics you don't like them to have anymore after Ramadan?
Well, I can't expect anything from the Muslim community, but all I can do is expect from myself. And there have been Ramadans, especially during my youth, like the Jahiliyyah days, where Ramadan was like nothingness. It was just another month on the lunar calendar. It really didn't make any difference. It didn't have any impact on my life. And looking back, I think the reason for it was my lack of knowledge, right? I didn't know any better, and I was so young, and I was so clueless, and I didn't have any motivation or drive in me to even find out what the month of Ramadan is and what I could achieve through it, right? But after growing up, like after repenting and growing up from my wild days and trying to fall back in love with Allah again, and trying to just
mend the relationship.
Exactly, mend the relationship and reconcile with my Lord and try to find a way toward Him, I felt like, oh my God, the month of Ramadan is like a freeway, you know, that you can go 180, 200 per hour, and snap, snap, you're there if you get it right. The month of Ramadan, I think Muharram, these 2 months really do a lot for your spiritual growth. And once you have that drive in you, that longing in you, that need in you to find God, then and only then can Ramadan mean anything to you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's just like another month.
I see.
And what I'd expect from myself, from stepping out of the month of Ramadan, I think, is to value my time more.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the turning point in my life in every way. Because during the month of Ramadan, since there's always emphasis on the fact that everything is amplified and you're rewarded like twofold, threefold, tenfold for everything that you do, you're like, oh my God, I only have 30 days to collect my provision for the next year, so I gotta do it quick. And then you step out of the holy month and you're like, if I could do that for 30 days and try to make some sort of benefit, something sustainable through every hour of my day, I can carry it out throughout the years too. So my time just automatically becomes more precious.
I see. Brother Ayman, what do you think of the provisions that Sister Zainab was referring to? Because, you know, sometimes we provide ourselves with these kinds of provision throughout the whole month of Ramadan, and we fast, we do all the things that we are required to do, but after Ramadan we do something that burns those provisions.
Yes.
And we are left with nothing in the hereafter.
I think the main reason for that is I can talk about in behalf of subcontinent. When I was child, when I used to go to mosque, the imam used to teach us usul-e-deen and furu-e-deen. When I came to Hawza, I learned about another dimension, which is akhlaq, and which comes after usul-e-deen, right?
Yes.
After the principles of religion is our ethics.
Yeah, but there is an interesting point I like to mention. The Imam Khomeini and Allama Hilli, they both have a different theory about that. They said the akhlaq comes before usul-e-deen. This is an interesting fact.
Okay, who says that?
Imam Khomeini and Allama Hilli.
I agree with them. They have my support.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I also believe on that too, because I've researched about it. And, you know, if you can teach the values of akhlaq, the principles of akhlaq to your kids, to your youth, right from the childhood, and that is all logical. The good thing about it, that is all logical.
Yes.
How you can teach them is basically we can teach them that, you know, when someone gives you a gift, right, you like to pay back to them. Is that make sense?
Yes.
So, you know, when you look around you, you see this whole universe, this world, your body, all those blessings. So you want to find out that being who has given these things to you. So you want to thank to that being, right? Imam Ali alayhi salam in Najul Balagha says that I do not I do not offer prayers in love of heaven or not in fear of hell. because I offer prayers just because the God deserves this.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful.
So this notion of deservance, you know, you need to teach that to your kids and to your child, to your children or to your families.
It transcends
them completely. Even if you have, even if you don't have this concept and you're going through Ramadan, Ramadan is not going to help you out. That Ramadan is basically useless for you. Because if you're not following that from your spirit, from your soul.
Mm-hmm.
But